Today's guest on The Year That Made Me declared himself on a lifelong quest to find the most cruisy, least challenging form of paid employment outside the upper house of the New South Wales Parliament. I'm not sure that he found it, but he has had a long life jobbing as a writer of all sorts of things. Most notably, his 1994 memoir of House Sharing Hell, He Died With a Falafel in His Hand, and the rollicking history of Sydney that he wrote without even getting the city's permission, Leviathan, the unauthorised biography of Sydney. John Birmingham's also written for publications from The Quarterly Essay to Penthouse and everything in between, which really is everything. These days, he's the author of several Substacks, including Alien Sideboob and his dive bar on the internet, Cheeseburger Gothic. In fact, Substack's a platform that's made possible for many creatives the sort of self-propelled writing career that John Birmingham has been living for decades without app support. John Birmingham, welcome to The Year That Made Me.
Hey, Julian. How are you?
Very well, very well. Where did the John Birmingham story begin, John? Where were you born?
In Liverpool, back in the UK, mate. My parents were 10-pound Poms who moved over here in September 1970. I think it was September 22 I set foot in Vegemite land for the first time. And I can still sort of recall that fierce antipodean glare sort of forcing me to squint as I came off the BOAC, VC10 or something, whatever it was in those days.
Now, this is something I actually have in common with you because I was born in the UK as well, came out at about the age of 8. I had a thick Lancashire accent when I came to Australia. Did you have a thick Liverpool accent, and how long did you have it for, if so?
Yeah, I had it until probably 5 or 6 fights in the schoolyard knocked it out of me.
Yeah, it doesn't take long.
It was super thick. My parents were, like, they were true Liverpudlians. They had gone on a date to the Cavern to watch the Beatles. Wow. That's how Liverpudlian they were, mate. So, it was pretty thick. And I suppose, like you with your accent, I did get teased about it at school. And I think from about, I don't know, maybe grade 3 or 4, I just started squeezing everything to the back of my nasal passages and grinding my teeth together and flattening all the vowels until the beatings stopped.
How did you get on with your parents, John?
Good. My mum's still around. So they were pretty good parents. They were, English working class. And I know from hearing their stories of growing up that they grew up like English working class did, like pretty hard. My mum was born in the middle of a German air raid on the Liverpool docks. My dad went from high school in grade 10 straight into the factory, which is how he got his ticket out here as a migrant. He was a steel worker, which was in want back then by the country. But they were interesting. Like without having had the benefit of any education for themselves beyond that really basic high school that they got over there, they were pretty determined that both their boys were going to get well educated and not end up in a factory like Dad. And so they were, when I look back, honestly, they were surprisingly supportive of some of the decisions I made in my 20s.
Yeah, I was wondering what they thought of the idea of their son trying to become a writer. When did you decide that you wanted to do that, and what did they think of it?
I think I would have been about 11 or 12, something like that. I'd always enjoyed reading, and I remember the first job I ever had was mowing the lawn for Mrs. McGrath next door, and I used to get like $2 a pop or something. And so after 3 weekends, I had enough to walk down into Ipswich and buy a book, which is what I, had always wanted to do with my summer, because I was, even back then I was a word nerd. I think I went into like a big supermarket. I didn't go into the bookstore. I just went into the supermarket and I found the fattest book I could get because I was after value, mate. And on that particular summer, the fattest book was Stephen King's The Stand. It was as big as a brick, but the thing that was really impressive to me was that it had this shiny writing on the cover that was sort of like pressed so that it was so thick. The typography, you get your fingers caught between the letters. And I thought, oh, mate, that looks like value. So I bought that. I loved it. And I loved it so much by the end of the book, I wanted to write my own. And I was away.
What was it like for you growing up in Joe Bjorke-Petersen's Queensland?
Look, at the time, I can't say that I enjoyed it a lot, but it was, given the title of your show, it really did make me. It's funny, you know, like at the time, we thought we were living in this kind of tropical fascist Disneyland, and we were all very dramatic about it. And it could be dramatic. Like, I knew people who had visits from Special Branch at 2 or 3 in the morning, and, you know, they'd drop a bag of dope on them and say, I reckon you should bugger off over the Rio Grande, mate. And they would. They'd have to go south of the Tweed and live down in Sydney or Melbourne. So all of that stuff, it all happened. But we also, you know, I think we probably over-dramatised it a bit as well. It certainly affected the way I thought of myself as a writer. Like, I eventually came to write books and got to know a lot of book writing types. I always thought of myself as not even a working journalist, but a working reporter in the style of, you know, Hunter Thompson or someone like that, somebody who went out and lived the story and then reported back from the jagged edge, which was a thing you did in your imagination in those days. And, you know, Petersen, for all of his sins, he gave me a lot to report back on.
I think that's the first time we've had someone thank Sir Joe Bjorke-Petersen on The Year That Made Me. So there's a first for everything. How early, John Birmingham, did writing start paying for you?
I would have been about 21, 22, I think. I did my arts degree at UQ, and I finished with, I think I had, I don't know, maybe $300 or $400 in student debt, because they just started to sort of, you know, nibble away at free education in those days. And I was horrified.
Yeah, that, like, was considered an outrage in the days. Some listeners will have drawers dropping thinking that a debt could be that small.
Yeah, no, how was I going to possibly live with this, you know, crushing mass of debt pressing down on me? So I was looking around for a job, and you might recall all the big departments and companies used to come out to campus in those days. I guess they still do. And I wasn't that interested in having a job. So I just thought, I'll do a few of these interviews for practice. And I went and chose some that seemed interesting. So I wanted to see what an ASIO guy looked like. So I went to the ASIO interview, and in 1985, he looked like a very big cane toad in a purple safari suit. And having enjoyed that, I then went back and thought, I'm going to do the Defense Department interview, see how much fun that is. And it was actually enormous fun. It was like an Air Force captain or colonel or something came out with a handlebar mustache.
Perfect.
An actual Battle of Britain mustache. And he showed us his video of F-111s swooping down through some valley and, like, you know, dropping a bomb on an old cow carcass or something. And he turned around to this, like, small tutorial room full of students, and he just went, F-111. Damn fine piece of fighting technology. And at that point I thought, mate, I'm so working with you. So that was my first job. But then I got to Canberra, and they didn't let me fly any F-111s or bomb any dead cows. And after about 2 or 3 minutes, I realized, oh my God, I'm a public servant. And I didn't cope. I quite enjoyed the work because I was a researcher. And so they used to send me out to research stuff, which was cool. But then I'd have to fill in flex forms and, you know, turn up at the office expecting me to get out of my pajamas, and it didn't speak to me, Julian. So after a while, I just thought, look, I'm out of here. At one point, I actually enrolled in clinical neuropsychology down at ANU because, you know, that had been part of my first degree, and I thought, I'll be a clinical neuropsychologist. And a friend of mine who worked in defense, Brett, he took me aside. He just said, look, mate, you don't want to be a neuropsychologist. You just desperately don't want to be a public servant. And that's when the light bulb came on, and I just threw my stuff in the car, drove back to Queensland, and I wrote my first paying story about a week later on, I think. It was a review of all the late night greasy eating joints in Brisbane. There was 3 of them. In those days, there was Lady Dies, which, like Lady Dies, sadly no longer with us. The Windmill, which is, and a place called Cadoo's Belly Button, where everything tasted as though it had been slow cooked in Mr. Cadoo's Belly Button. $30 I got for that first story.
And you were off.
And I was away, mate. I thought $30 for, you know, going out and eating greasy food at 2 a.m. was, I'd cracked the code. This was it. This is what I was going to do the rest of my life.
It still sounds like not too bad a deal. Our guest on The Year That Made Me is John Birmingham. And John, we're still in the early years, which I think is whereabouts you've chosen a year that made you. What year have you chosen and why?
1989 for a couple of reasons. One, it was the year that this sort of crazed plan I had to become a freelance writer. And in those days, I thought of myself as a freelance writer, not as a novel writer or anything like that. I really, really wanted to work for magazines. That's all I wanted to do. And that was the year that it started to come together, again, partly thanks to J.P. Elke Peterson. It was also the year I met my wife, but I didn't realize at that point she was going to become my wife. That was going to be another, I don't know, 7 or 8 years in the future. And it was also the year, having met Jane, where I also met most of my campus friends who became that group of friends you have with you for the rest of your life, no matter what. So it was a pretty big year.
Tell us about meeting Jane.
We met during a violent political demonstration on campus in Queensland.
Again, Joe Bjocke-Peterson can claim credit here.
He can. I guess he can, yeah. Well, Joe was gone by that stage. He'd sort of been shuffled off the scene about 1987, thanks to the ABC, actually, and Four Corners and Phil Dickey's reports in the Courier Mail. It basically just documented what everybody knew, which was this grotesquely corrupt system at work in Queensland. And he had not survived that, which was a surprise to all of us. But the National Party government was still in. So there was a lot of pushback against them at both the state political level, but down on the street as well. And there was like silly stuff going on, like the University of Queensland Student Union put a condom vending machine on campus and hordes of cops came out to tear it off the wall. And it was silly things like that. And silly things being my forte, I was right into it and writing them up. I had by that point started writing for Rolling Stone magazine because I'd won their Young Writer of the Year competition. Something happened at UQ where for the first time ever, some very, very conservative students from the Young Liberal Party and the Young National Party got control of the union. These guys ran a pretty good campaign and they won it fair and square. And they were just so excited. I think the very first day they took office, they must have sat up all night drinking rum and Cokes. Like, what are we going to do? And so they decided the first thing they were going to do is, like a South American dictator, seize the radio stations. So Triple Z, which was the community radio station in Brisbane, was quartered on campus. It had a little office. And so in my memory, they hired a bunch of nightclub bouncers, arm-locked these filthy hippies, threw them out. And unfortunately for them, the hippies were quite technically adept, so they drove up to Mount Kurtha and there was a little retransmitter tower up there and they plugged a magic box into it. And, you know, like the sort of French resistance, they started broadcasting to Brisbane. Anyway, by mid-morning, there's thousands of students on campus protesting. And so I spoke to the editor at Rolling Stone. I said, this is a pretty good story for us. So I went out to campus and I was out there covering a bunch of these demos, and they occupied the student union building and the cops came in to throw them out. And I remember I bodgied up my own press pass, but the cops couldn't figure that out. So they looked at me like, what are you doing? Oh, press. And so I was able to sort of charge in after them. So they ran in. There was like 20 or 30 of these guys. They're throwing students left, right. And there's two probationary constables came in at the end. They were so hyped up, so excited, but there was no students left to beat up. No condom vending machines to pull off the wall. So one of the last one comes in, he's looking left, he's looking right. And he just, only thing he can see is this phone. So he picks a phone up and he just throws it on the ground. Take that. So I went from that up to the student newspaper office to write my notes of this particular incident, which was one of many that year. I was just sitting there at the desk writing my notes, looked up and I said, oh my God, my eventual wife had just walked in. I'm like, oh God. And then I realized very quickly that she was dating the graphic designer, who was this incredibly handsome and talented, thin European man with perfect hair. And so I went, oh yeah, okay, whatever. Went back to writing my story. And that was how we met.
John Birmingham, you've written all sorts of books, fiction and nonfiction, over the years, but we've spoken so far about your freelance short form writing. Looking back over that, what's the short form writing you're most and least proud of?
Probably the stuff I did for Rolling Stone. In both cases, there was pieces I did for them that I was really proud of. There was a lot of neo-Nazis hanging around Sydney in the 1980s. I can't believe I just said that, given the world we live in now. They burned down a couple of restaurants and harassed a couple of people. And having come from Queensland, I thought, oh, I know where this ends. So I ended up doing a big story about them. And I was the only reporter who was covering them in those days. So I was happy with that story. And then there was another piece. I started thinking about it towards the end of 89. Listeners of a certain age will recall of a brave but probably silly promise Bob Hawke made that by 1990, no child would live in poverty.
Yes, indeed.
And, you know, I looked at my watch around about September, October. I thought, oh, gee, 1990 is coming up. I wonder if there's going to be any poverty hanging around in a few weeks. So I said, look, I'm going to go live on the streets for a month or so. And so I moved from Brizzy down to Sydney. I think the first couple of days I was sleeping on the couch at Rolling Stone while I acclimatized. And then I just moved onto a step outside of Woolies in King's Cross. And that became my home for the near future. And I did the job. I lived on the streets. I hung around with homeless people, got into some trouble with them here and there because, you know, I look like a narc. I look like an undercover cop. And I always have. I remember once it was cold one night and I was hanging around the grates in front of King's Cross Railway Station talking to this bloke, Graham. He was an ex-Navy guy who had ended up on the streets and he was telling me the story of how that had happened. And for some reason, you know, I didn't tell anybody what I was doing, but I felt the urge to tell Graham. So I said to him, yes, I'm a freelance writer gathering notes for a magazine story on homelessness. And he looked at me and he just went, yeah, I'm unemployed to myself at the moment.
Very wise man.
Yeah, but that story came out and it should have been great. It should have been a triumph. And it wasn't because I was young. I was really immature. I didn't have the skills to pull all of the threads together. Like I could do it now and not break a sweat. Although I got to tell you, there's no way I'm going to go live on that step.
And they'd still pick you out as a narc.
Yeah, they would, totally. They'd see me coming. But I wanted to do this story. I felt it was important and nobody else was doing that kind of thing. But there's a reason they give these things to the grizzled old veterans, because the grizzled old veterans know what they're doing. And I didn't. And so I look back on that story now. It was a failed story. I did the right thing going and doing it, but I really, I didn't do the job properly. My skills weren't there.
John, could you talk a little about the trajectory of He Died With a Falafel in His Hand and the impact it had on your life?
Yeah. I was living in a couple of houses that year that feature in Falafel. The house I was in at the start of 89 was this wretched Queenslander backing onto the train line in Turinga. I think there was like 7 or 8 of us living there. There wasn't much furniture. A TV set, I think, was it. There was magic mushrooms growing in the front yard. A tree had grown up between two windows, so you couldn't shut them anymore. The bathroom had sort of slipped off its stump, because this is a Queenslander, it's on stumps. So the bathroom, it was like surfing when you were in there having a shower. It was a wretched place, but it gave me some great stories for that book, including the night I came home and found my flatmate Pete. Actually, he'd been out grazing on the magic mushies in the front yard, and he was sitting on the floor of the living room watching TV. He had a couple of frilled lizards sitting on his shoulders. I thought I was the one who was hallucinating, but no, it was Pete. I got evicted from that place by Pete. He said I had a bad vibe. To be fair to Pete, I probably did, because I was studying law at the time, because once I committed myself to writing, I was kind of anxious because I thought, you know, this could end badly. I'd been in a student newspaper when an old hippie journalist had wandered in to pitch some story for 10 or 20 bucks or something, and he had his little string bag, and I just looked at him and I thought, oh my God, that could be me in 15 years' time. So I enrolled in law to give myself something to fall back on if writing didn't work out. And I realized within about 2 or 3 weeks that it was law that wasn't going to work out. It all built to a head one day where my frustration with the legal profession caused me to punch out a wall in this terrible house, after which I was evicted because I had bad vibes. And, you know, Pete was right, I did. So I moved from there to some other place with, I think, my brother, a guy called Granger, who features heavily in that book. I went from there to a couch in a house full of students, and from that couch to the couch at Rolling Stone. Sleeping on couches was a sort of leitmotif of my early writing career. By the time I got to Sydney, I had managed to get myself a gig at a place called The Independent Monthly, because they had a young writer competition, and I had chosen my topic well, because it was, again, back in 89, it was right at the end of the Bjelke-Petersen regime, and there were all these street protests about freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, the right to march, and stuff like that. And so I got myself a little piece of paper, and I wrote in tiny little words in the middle of the paper, free speech. And I went to the Queen Street Mall, and I held it up, and I was arrested.
Wow.
And I wrote that story up for the Indy, and I won the comp. So they gave me a little 2 or 3 month contract to write for them out of that. And so by 93, 94 or something, I had become a relatively successful freelancer. The thing about working for magazines is there will come a day where you walk into the magazine and you smell death. I walked in one morning and I smelt it on the air. I sort of ran across to Michael Duffy, who was the deputy editor. He was setting up Duffy and Snow Rovers, which originally it was a small press called the Yellow Press. And that was his escape from our dying magazine. And he said, look, I'm doing this. I can toss you a couple of grand. Can you write me a stocking stuffer for Christmas? It needs to be done really quickly. And I went, I've got some flatmate stories. So I banged out a sample chapter overnight and I gave it to him. And he said, yeah, I think this will work. Can you get me the manuscript in about 5 weeks? And I went, yeah, you give me an advance and I'll see what I can do. So I think he coughed up $4,000 or something. And I spent a lot of that on hot chips, red wine and stimulants and just crashed this thing out over 5 weeks or so with some help from some friends and my flatmates. And it came out and it died. It was not an immediate success because he was a small independent publisher. And I had foolishly insisted that he print this thing in a square format because that was what the original Generation X was published in. And I just thought, I want to be Douglas Copeland. So I said, Michael, you have to do this in square format. So the bookstores just wouldn't stock it. They said it doesn't fit on the shelves. But there was this one guy, he was a distributor, and he loved the book. He would just keep harassing and harassing bookstores to stock it. And so there were people who did pick it up, and then word of mouth began to spread. And one place it spread was to a weird little Keating government training program in Sydney, where if you were a bunch of unemployed people and you had an idea for a business, you could pool a year's worth of dole checks, unemployment benefits, to run your business. 15 or 16 of these unemployed actors had set up a theatre company called Cyclone, and they were being trained to run a theatre company. And part of their training was to adapt a book for the stage. And one of the young actors said, oh, I read this weird book about share housing. I think it'll make a good play. So they tracked me down. I was living at Bondi at that point, and they took me out for beers, and I signed away the rights to this thing on the back of a beer mat from the Bondi Hotel. And it then, you know, it ran for 5 or 6 years. And I suspect that that combination of that guy up in Brisbane who just would not stop trying to distribute this book and those kids doing this little guerrilla theatre operation in Roselle in Sydney was just enough of a spark to keep it going. And then eventually something weird happened and it took off.
It's been going ever since.
Yeah, it has.
John, it's been absolutely fantastic chatting about the old days with you. Thank you so much for joining us on The Year That Made Me.
Thanks, buddy.
And of course, we finished The Year That Made Me with a piece of music. You chose 1989 as your year. What piece of music have you chosen for us and why?
I chose a song called Tonight Tonight by The Smashing Pumpkins, because 89, as I said, was the year that I first met Jane, who would become my wife. And this song, the lyrics of this song in particular, spoke to us. It didn't come out until, I think, 93 or something like that. But in my memory, it is the soundtrack of that entire period.
John Birmingham, thanks again.
Thank you.
And here's The Smashing Pumpkins, Tonight Tonight.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.